Just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
And hello, and welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org, and we are on iTunes. If you go down to public radio, you'll click on KUCI FM, and there we are. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing, as always, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents talking about the business and the art of writing. Today, we have another wonderful show. We have Chris Bajalian and Alice Firing. First up is Chris Bajalian. Chris is the author of 11 novels. He's been on before with a couple of them and with his collection of essays. And his most recent book is Skeletons at the Feast, published by Shea Earhart Books. And I'd like to bring him on right away. He's here for a half hour, and we want to fit it all in. So, hi, Chris.
Barbara, it's lovely to hear you. How are you?
Good. Great to have you on again. And you've done it again, huh? You've written another excellent book that is, it's full of so much. It's so full of research. It's so full of love and heart and story. Will you talk a little bit about what inspired Skeletons at the Feast?
Oh, sure. Skeletons at the Feast had its origins way back in 1998 when a good friend of mine and I were picking up our daughters at kindergarten, and he asked if I would take a look at his grandmother's diary. His mother had just translated it from German into English and typed it up. Now, normally, when somebody says to a novelist, "Would you look at the family diary?" your immediate reaction is, "No, please, just begin the waterboard torture now." Anything but that. But I'm good friends with this fellow, and so I said, sure, I'd be honored to read it. His grandmother had grown up in Germany and lived in Germany from 1898 until 1945. From 1920 to 1945, she had been the matriarch on a massive, baronial, Tolstoy-like estate in East Prussia. And by the standards of the 1920s and the 1930s, this was agribusiness. They grew sugar beets on the farm, and they grew sugar beets as far as the eye could see in all directions. The diary that my friend gave me was 180 pages typed, single-spaced. About 150 of them were about beets and sort of about the minutia of, you know, raising a family in a still rural corner of Europe. 30 pages, however, were about the Second World War and were really interesting. And about 5 pages were set on one spectacularly horrific day in 1945 and were among the most riveting pages I had ever read in my life. I shared the diary with some friends of mine at Random House and some friends of mine at a university press, and they read it, and they all said the same thing in 1998. A lot of beets. You know, there wasn't stuff in there that, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there they loved, but they weren't about to publish it. And in the late 1990s, it wouldn't have crossed my mind that there might have been a novel set in this period in history, because I was writing books like Midwives or Transistor Radio or The Law of Similars, novels about the way the cultural margins were pressing against the mainstream at the end of the 20th century. So, 1998, segue to 2002, segue to 2006, and I happened to be reading a nonfiction account of the last year of the war in Germany by the esteemed British historian Max Hastings. And as I was reading this book, I kept having these freakish moments of déjà vu, these moments that would bring me back to I wasn't sure what, and then I realized the diary. The diary, and I'll share with you two moments from Hastings' account that brought me back to the diary. First of all, he talked about the hundreds of thousands of German refugees in 1945 who were trying to stay ahead of the Soviet army, and these horrific traffic jams at the frozen Vistula River as the refugees hoped to cross it and the Soviet shells were falling upon it, turning the river into ice shavings and ice slivers. Well, I mentioned 5 pages that were particularly riveting. Well, those 5 pages in the diary occurred on the eastern banks of the Vistula River. The diarist had realized in early January that to keep her family safe, she needed to start walking west on foot, to give up everything, this life as a baroness, and become a refugee. Because if she didn't know the details of the atrocities the Nazis had committed in Russia, she had her fears. If she didn't know the details of the horrors the Nazis were committing even then in Poland and Germany, she had her fears. And so she started west, and she was a part of one of those horrible traffic jams at the Vistula. And in fact, she and her daughters were among some of the very last to cross the river at that particular stretch. And then there was this moment in Hastings' book. He talked about this bizarre footnote to the end of the Second World War, when the Nazis, out of slave labor, actually sent some of their British and American prisoners of war from the Stalags to these massive fields, wheat fields, apple orchards, and beet farms in Prussia and Pomerania to help with a harvest. And, he wrote, invariably, certain romances would develop between the American and the British POW and the teenage German farm girl. Well, the diary. The diary. Christmas Eve, 1944, the diarist knows that it is her last Christmas on this estate, that soon she will be going west, giving up everything. But what is making her smile at watching her 16-year-old daughter and her daughter's female friends dancing with, quote-unquote, those 7 lovely English boys? She had 7 POWs living on the estate, and not in some bunkhouse, not under guard, each with their own bedroom in this massive, sprawling mansion. So I picked up the phone after I read Hastings' book, and I called my friend and said, could I look at your grandmother's diary again? He said, sure. And then I called up that 16-year-old girl, who at the time was 77 years old and living in Portland, Maine, and said, I don't know quite what I want to do with this material, but there's something in your mother's diary that is inspiring me to write a novel. How do you feel about that? It would not be your story. It would not be your mother's story, but how do you feel about it? And she said, fine. And so the very next day, I started trying to find all the Holocaust survivors, all of the Germans, all of the Poles that I could, who'd been in that part of Germany, in Poland, in that nightmarish 6 months. And I started getting their stories, and I was off and running on the novel that would be Skeletons at the Feast.
Mm. Well, I'll tell you, it's such a gripping book, and I don't know. I mean, in recent years, I tend to perhaps not want to read about this period of time, and because it's all too apparent still. And so when I learned of the subject matter of your new book, and I always love your work, I went, oh no! And then I started reading it, and I was so taken by the story, so taken by the relationships, and of course by the writing, that I really couldn't put it down. And times I should have been writing, actually, I was reading. And I wondered then, and throughout the book, I wondered how it is to write about such a difficult time, because there's so much pain throughout this book, as well as, you know, lovely moments, but so much difficulty that you had to, of course, experience in some way in writing about it, as well as all of the research. What do you do with all that? I mean, are you able to be removed enough so that it doesn't affect you perhaps the same way it affects a reader?
Well, I do compartmentalize myself, and I always have compartmentalized myself. I mean, you know, the reality is, you know, I'm the guy who wrote the novel about the midwife who plunges a knife into a pregnant woman. But the reality is, this was a different experience writing this book from anything I had done in the past. You're spot on correct in that regard. I interviewed a number of people, and their stories would leave me shaking when I was done because of the appalling inhumanity and just the horrific barbarism of which people were capable, and, you know, if we look at Darfur, are capable of even, mm-hmm. even now. I mean, that is the thing. We just haven't gotten better. We have not found a more authentic moral compass to drive us forward in all too many cases. But here's the other thing. For every moment of unspeakable horror, for every act of brutality, somebody would tell me a story of beauty and grace and inexplicable kindness. And I hope that for every moment of, you know, cold and ice and blood that fills Skeletons at the Feast, there's a moment that will make you, you know, smile wistfully at the resiliency of the human spirit and the beauty of the human spirit. The other day, a reader asked me this question. She said, why did you feel the need to put in those naughty bits? And I knew what she meant. You know, the naughty bits was her sort of euphemism for a couple of sex scenes involving Anna, my heroine, and Callum, her lover. Mm-hmm. And I loved her choice of the word need, because I did need to put those scenes in, not simply because after all my characters are enduring at this book, they needed those moments of beauty and love, but I think as the writer, perhaps, I needed them as well.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to sort of escape from being a refugee. I needed to escape from the concentration camp. I needed to escape from the barbarity, the barbarism of the Soviet army at that place and time. And, you know, when I talk about this book, I always try to bring it back to the fact that, in my mind, I was always writing, I hoped, on some level, a love story, almost a love triangle between my three main characters.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. And you have, which is an interesting composition, you know, to deal with such a difficult topic and time, and then to deal with love and what goes on with these people. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm with Chris Bojalian, author of Skeletons at the Feast. Talk about the title a little bit.
The title, Skeletons at the Feast. Well, there's a tradition in some African and some Central American cultures in which you have a skeleton at the feast or at a big party. So the revelers never forget the fact that while they're having a great time now, the good times won't last forever, and eventually we are all going to be dust. In my case, it comes from a line of dialogue in the novel in which Anna's father has gone to Anna's uncle and has said, "The Russians are coming. We need to evacuate now." And mordantly, you know, with great resignation, her uncle says to her father, "Let's face it, these days you and I, our families, our world are nothing more than skeletons at the feast anyway." And he will not leave, and it has dire consequences for his daughters and granddaughters.
Yeah, when I came across that line in the book, I went, I wondered also then if you had the title first or if it came out of the text later.
It came out of the text later. I'm a firm believer, and I'm about to share with you more about marketing than you probably need to know, but I'm a firm believer that the most successful books commercially have got three words in the title, first word, the. The Great Gatsby, The Kite Runner, The Lovely Bones, The Da Vinci Code, Double Bind. So I really wanted this book to have a three-word title, and originally I was actually toying with titles like The Prussian Girl, but given you know the associations we have with Prussia and militarism, I decided not to go there. And then, of course, Peter Hodavies came out with a book called The Welsh Girl, and that sort of made it clear that I should not be calling this The Prussian Girl, which is why I wanted Skeletons at the Feast, which isn't three words, and maybe that explains why it only spent 1 week on the New York Times bestseller list and never made the Los Angeles Times bestseller list.
Not yet. And the title is an interesting contrast to the lovely idyllic cover of the book. It's interesting.
Well, the cover is a lovely image of a young woman in profile, looking wistful in a field out at something, and it's got great, you know, sort of orange and autumnal hues to it. There is, I have noticed, a look for my book, certainly the last three that Random House has published there. It's Before You Know Kindness, The Double Bind, and Skeletons at the Feast. And yes, they all share young woman in profile looking away from the spine of the book.
Oh, interesting stuff. Let's hear from you. Let's hear from the book, and love to hear you read it. Read a few pages.
Sure. And I'm going to ask you, would you rather I read a brief, not a love scene, but a soft moment between Anna and Callum, or would you prefer I read the opening from the prologue?
Read the opening.
Okay, this is how Skeletons at the Feast opens.
Yeah.
The girl, a young woman really, 18, hair the color of corn silk, had been hearing the murmur of artillery fire for 2 days now. Everyone had. A rare and peculiar winter thunderstorm in the far distance. Little more. The sconces in the ballroom hadn't twitched. The sconces in the living room hadn't twitched. The chandelier in the ballroom, a modest ballroom, but a ballroom nonetheless, barely had trembled. The horses, while she was harnessing them and helping to load the wagons, had looked up. But the animals hadn't expressed particular interest. If, Anna surmised, they had thought of anything, they had thought of the cold. It was one of those frigid weeks when the days would alternate between whiteout like snowstorms and periods so still that the smoke from the chimneys would rise up into a slate-gray sky in lines that were perfectly straight. These shells, however, the ones that were falling this afternoon, were great concussive blasts that had the people and the horses, a seemingly endless caravan of strangers that clogged the road and crushed the snow and ice along the sides, and had come almost to a complete stall now before the river, fidgeting and fretting in place. At each explosion, the animals whinnied and the babies, hungry and chilled despite the blankets and furs in which they were swaddled, cried out. If they managed to free one of their little hands, the blue fist would lash out, a small spring-loaded paddle. Clearly, however, the artillery had leapfrogged over them. Hours earlier, it had been many kilometers to the east. Now it was ahead of them to the west. Some of the shells were falling so nearby that they heard the screech, a strange foreign animal, something that might exist in a tree in Africa or South America, the girl thought, before the reverberant burst left them crouching, anxious, in their places in line. At first, she presumed the Russians were trying to hit them, this long line of families trying desperately to flee to the west, to take out the carts and the wagons and the walkers piecemeal. But then she understood their real intent. It was the river itself. They were trying to smash the buttress-thick ice that coated this stretch of the Vistula from shore to shore like a skating rink and was serving as a bridge because the nearest stone and cement overpass was 25 kilometers to the north. Along the shore, she saw soldiers and Volkstrom teenagers, boys who were easily 2 and 3 years younger than her twin brother and her, funneling the refugees across what they believed was the safest part of the ice. But she had the sense that any moment now, people were going to start leaving the queue and fanning out into the woods where they would cross the river wherever they could. Or, at least, believed that they could. The girl had heard stories of wagons and families disappearing yesterday and the day before through the ice to the north and the south. She wasn't sure if they were true, but so much of the last month had been a study in how things she had once thought were inconceivable were actually happening.
Thank you so much. That was Chris Bajalian reading from Skeletons at the Feast, published by Shea Earhart Books. And it's a book sense pick as well. And, it's such a powerful story. And I'll tell you, it's interesting in dealing with the last 6 months of World War II, where someone like me is not going to read a history book about that time. I think I read Jerzy Kaczynski years ago, Painted Bird.
I love the Painted Bird.
That book. And this reminded me of that. It reminded me of that without sort of the love story, you know. It's sort of like taking you into that time so that you can understand it, but from a fictional point of view.
Well, you know, you mentioned The Painted Bird, some of my very, very favorite novels are these great, sweeping World War II love stories. Sophie's Choice, The English Patient, mm-hmm. Corelli's Mandolin, Atonement. I think one of the reasons why I loved writing this book so much is because I was finally old enough to appreciate the gravitas of history and the epic nature of that moment in our world. And I do love stories, and I think that was one of the things that drew me to this material. It is easier to face this particular maelstrom, this crucible of history, in some ways from a fictional love story than it might be from a nonfiction account. And this was, in my opinion, the most horrific 6 months in the history of the world, especially on the Eastern Front. On the Eastern Front, there were the concentration camps that were still functioning prior to the Soviet liberation. Auschwitz, for example, was at its most nightmarishly efficient in the 3 months before the Soviets liberated it. There were the concentration camps that were being evacuated by the Nazis for reasons that are inexplicable and inhumane, marching their prisoners west in the cold and ice and snow, usually without boots. There's the Russian military strategy that came down to one word, attrition. How many men can you throw against a pillbox? There were the remnants of the German army fighting like cornered wolves, teenage boys and middle-aged men, because they know they cannot possibly surrender after the atrocities their army has committed in the East. And there were the refugees, the girls, the boys, the teenagers, the senior citizens, the mothers. 750,000 to a million Prussians walking west on foot, trying desperately to stay ahead of the Soviet army, most hoping that somehow they will reach the British and the American lines, because they know that is their only chance of getting out. To give you a sense of the magnitude of the carnage, because the numbers are just, your eyes glaze. The greatest maritime disaster in the history of the world, we all assume, was the Titanic. April 1912, 1,500 people drowned. In reality, the greatest maritime disaster in the history of the world occurred on January 30th, 1945. It was the Wilhelm Gustloff. a cruise ship put into service to evacuate civilians from the surrounded East Prussian city of Danzig. The city is now surrounded, so you can no longer leave on foot. The only way out is by boat. Think of the helicopters in Saigon in 1975. Mm-hmm. Everyone is throwing themselves onto this boat. 10,000 people are on board when it set sail that night. It's sunk by a Russian submarine 45 minutes later, and 9,500 people drown in a heartbeat, or six times as many people as died on the Titanic. But given the magnitude of the death and the carnage on the Eastern Front, it's you know, invisible to all of us in the West. It's just sort of one more drop in a very bloody bucket.
Wow. And we're at the end of our time once again. It always seems like you come on and then it's done. But
Barbara, it's always a pleasure. I love talking to you about books. I love your show. It is always such a privilege for me. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And any words of wisdom for our listeners?
Any words of wisdom about life or about writing?
About writing. Let's focus on writing.
Yeah.
How about life?
If you're a writer, write in a genre you love. If you love romance novels, write a romance. If you love literary fiction, write literary fiction. But I find time and again, whenever a writer, and I'm including me, tries to write about things I don't love and in a genre I don't love, it is a train wreck.
Mm-hmm. Yes, how it is. And we look forward to your next book, and best of luck with this one. This is wonderful. Everyone, this should be required reading, actually, this book, for many reasons, but yeah.
Well, from your lips to readers' ears, thank you.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Take care.
That was Chris Bajalian talking to us from Vermont, where he lives with his family. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a few minutes with Alice Firing and more Writers on Writing. Don't go away.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm still Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We're back for the second half of the show. If you want to know more about the show or who's going to be on, please visit my website, which is penonfire.com. And if you click on the radio tower, you will arrive at the radio page, which will give you a mostly current schedule. Sometimes I get a little behind, but, you know, I can't do everything here. We're also on iTunes. You go to Radio Public Scan Down for KUCI FM, and we podcast. You can get to the podcast through my website. We are back, and now we have Alice Firing on. She's a New York-based downtown kind of wine writer who has also made her tub in the kitchen and her wine Curious Plumber famous in her New York Times essays. She is a vineyard-hopping James Beard Award-winning journalist who writes regularly for the New York Times as well as for major glossies. For 2 years, she was the wine travel columnist for Time magazine, showing America how to maximize their journey to wine countries worldwide. As the only major writer focusing on wine's authenticity, her blog, AliceFiring.com, was named as one of Food and Wine magazine's best. Harcourt has just published her book, The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization. Hi, Alice.
Hey, Barbara.
Great to have you on.
Barbara, I think we're having a little technical difficulty.
You can't hear me?
A little fuzzy on your end.
You know, you sound great, so if you can hear me, you sound fine.
Okay, I may have some difficulty, but...
Well, I'll try to talk loudly, but
okay.
I don't think we can do anything about it. Some connections are just that way, unfortunately.
Just that way, I understand.
Talk a little bit about how this book came about.
Yeah, well, I've been kind of trying to find that idea for years. I knew that I was driven to write a book about my point in the natural wine movement and basically my journey through it. But I just couldn't, these ideas don't grow on trees, they're inspirations, and it took me a long time to get to it. So I wrote a very boring proposal, something called Honest Wine Guide, and I was circulating it, and it was totally unsexy. And one, I was looking for a new agent, and the last one who rejected me said, this isn't the book that you want to write. And I really wanted to like this book, but this just isn't it, so bye and have a nice day. And I said, thank you very much, and I got off the phone, and I was furious, and it wasn't that she was, I was very much writing about what I wanted to write, but I just didn't do a really good job of convincing her. And I was, I went to ballet class, and I was in the middle of a plié, and I went, oh my God, The Battle for Wine and Love, and just like I ran home, I rewrote the proposal, and then everybody wanted it. And it is really, I guess I was trying to, soft soap the idea and just make it into a guide and some nice, pleasant thing as opposed to really using my passion for it. And just decided to, all I've got is me, and I put myself thoroughly in the book, and then that's what happened.
Mm. You know, I think we share an agent as well as an editor, Betsy Amster.
Did I know this?
I just found out through reading your acknowledgments.
Funny. That's funny. I knew that is really funny. Yes, and actually the story to how I found Betsy was very funny. After the last experience, well, you look for an agent, and so what do? You kind of ask your friends who they work with and whether, you like them. I went to some editors, and so I basically went through who you know. Then when I rewrote this proposal, I decided I'm not going to anybody I know. No one. I'm going to just, I've got a good title, I'm going to go with it, I've got a good proposal, and I sent it to a bunch of people, and then actually a friend of mine said, you know, I just met this guy on a boat, and why don't I just send, he's got a publishing house down in Atlanta, or is it in Birmingham, and why don't we just send him your proposal and see what he thinks? He called me up, and I thought I was just, you know, I'd been rejected by everybody, so it was like, all right, let's, you know, maybe this one's going to be bad, too, and let's see what Bob Selinger has to say. And within 2 days, Bob called me up and said, I loved your proposal, and I want to publish it, and I want to represent it, but I'm not the right publisher, and I'm not an agent, but I work with somebody in Los Angeles, and her name is Betsy Amster.
Interesting.
So that's how I got to Betsy. So in the end, it was kind of through a connection.
But, I love how the title came to you and how, you know, you were originally thinking prescriptive nonfiction, perhaps, and not, you know, let me write something that I'm going to have fun with, that I'm going to put my voice in, that's going to be me.
Yeah.
And it has such a wonderful voice, and it's, you know, it's the sort of wine book that I'm interested in, whereas I would not read a book about, you know, wines. I just wouldn't.
Right, exactly. And actually, one of the things that I was trying to do in this was to bring some of my essay work, which I love writing essays, and also I hate being bored when I read a book on anything, and so I think it's just criminal for a writer to write boring things. and that's not what I get bored. I can't, you know, there are some times that I'm just writing something, oh my God, this is so boring, so do I have to finish it? And I didn't, this one I was very into, and I just loved writing it. But I also wanted to try to bring to the world something about what does capture my imagination when it comes to wine. What is it about? You know, it's not about just something good to drink, but it's culture, and I wanted to put some of that into it.
Mm-hmm. Will you read to us from The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization? What a good title.
Thank you. So it's all scattered throughout in the narrative. There's actually quite a bit of geeky technical stuff, but I think that the best place to start is at the beginning, so I'll read from Chapter 1, The Age of Innocence.
Okay.
When my world was still innocent, I was drinking Manischewitz mixed with seltzer. But by the time my father ran off after a neighbor's wife, I was drinking the partially fizzy Matisse. I had a multitude of reasons for disliking the object of Dad's affection, and all of them seemed to find expression in my developing an allergy to her Siamese cats and an aversion to her vulgar perfume. Obviously, this Madame's chow-chow of a woman had a profound effect on my sinuses. Nevertheless, I remain indebted to her. Years after my family's little scandal cooled down, she and my father were cohabitating. I had run away to graduate school in the Boston area and was starting to cultivate an interest in wine. When I was visiting my father on a school break, she invited me to raid her husband's ex-wine cellar. Her ex-husband's wine cellar. Still terribly shy at 23, I was hesitant to appear greedy, and so I took only 3 bottles out of the hundreds there. One was an Italian wine from Piedmont, a 1968 Barolo, made by someone named Giovanni Scannavino. I packed the bottles carefully, took a $19 People's Express flight back to Boston, shared the wine with 2 friends and my boyfriend, a rather sweet but straight-laced guy who barely drank and who knew I didn't like that he barely drank. The drinking became an even bigger issue when he saw me take my first smell of the Barolo. As far as Mr. Straightlace was concerned, it was as though I had just fallen in love with another man. What was the attraction? Everything. Excuse me. The Barolo's aromas and taste of rose petals and its suede-like tannin. There was also a bit of gravel and tar in tea. In later years, I heard that most people couldn't understand this kind of old-world-style Barolo, a wine that in its youth was supposedly wildly rough, hard, and needed at least 20 years to reveal itself. In 1980, that Barolo was preteen, but it had already grown up gorgeous. I didn't need anyone to tell me it was phenomenal. I figured it out with my own nose. As a pigtailed, freckled kid, I was obsessed with smells. My mother would nervously scold, "Stop smelling your food." My father, a lawyer with a penchant for controversy, threatened to call the sheriff. My older brother mimicked me, and then they finally threw up their hands, resigned to the fact that I was eccentric. Waving everything under my nose before putting it into my mouth was a strong reflex for me as sneezing. Sun-kissed orange juice ice pop clutched in my little fist, lick, sniff, lick. Friday night dinner, Mom's fragrant tomato soup cupped in my spoon. Slurp, sniff, slurp. Nothing and no one could break me of this behavior. They say that non-tasters do not produce super-tasters. In my case, with my mother and father being almost anosmics, the smell gene skipped a generation and landed in me. They came from my mother's father. Pop had a particularly prominent and fine nose. He must have seen that I was a kindred spirit, because when I was a wee one, he engaged me in early aroma training. He liked to keep little bottles of perfume in his long underwear drawer, of all places. He would call to me, "Come, Mamala," wave scents under my nose, and then quiz me on what I perceived. He didn't speak much English, and I had little Yiddish, but somehow we communicated just fine. When I was not much older, he would say, "Mamala, a bissel schnapps," and give me a fingernail mound of whiskey, but we always smelled it before we sipped. I'm grateful for learning how to enter the world nose first. My exaggerated sense of smell and taste are still my antenna to the world. They allow me to know what lobster and pig's feet taste like and to make appropriate wine pairings, though having grown up in a kosher home, I've eaten neither. Smells have always warned me of danger, like the time I sniffed a trout from head to tail, refused to eat it, and was the only one at the meal who didn't get sick. And romance would not be possible with a man who smelled bad to me. Conversely, it is an undeniable asset when a suitor smells like truffle.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was Alice Fiering, reading from The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization, published by Harcourt. Wanted to ask you, in terms of the voice of the book and what you were doing before, when you got into your head that it was going to be more of a personal book and more of a book in your voice, did the whole project change for you?
Well, it actually didn't. What changed is that I focused my book on plot,
mm-hmm.
You know, basically. And so I think in that way, I'm probably the only person who has written a wine book that is narrative nonfiction,
mm-hmm.
that does read with a plot line, that there is an actual beginning, middle, and end. When I had developed the proposal, it was a bit fragmented. And actually, all of my chapters are the same, but when writing through the proposal, I did develop the arc, and I viewed it as something essential and something that was definitely going to set this one apart.
Interesting. Now, you published in April of 2007, you published a modern love essay, How My Plumber Turned Water into Wine, which is actually how I found you, because I was going through the modern love essays and read this one and loved this one and thought, who's this writer? I wonder if this writer has any books. And so, of course, that's when I Googled your name and found you. At what point did this essay come in? Was it after the book was in process?
Yes, the book was in process. Let's see. Gosh, I lost time when I wrote this book, trying to put everything in perspective. Yes, it was April 2007. The book was, I was already working on the second draft of the book at that time. And it, it came about just very much the way I wrote that, you know, I wrote the essay. How to explain this? In the book, I do use the breakup of an 11-year breakup and the heartbreak that ensued from that. And really, the inspiration for this book, I mean, that essay, I was out and I met this guy, and we were drinking really, really great old wine. And I was like, "Gosh, I haven't felt this in a really long time, and this is so great." And yes, I remember what connection is about. And I came home. I had a visitor staying with me who was a rather large gentleman. I have a very old apartment with very old plumbing, and he had, while he was snoring away, I went to the bathroom and, you know, like, there was water everywhere. So I realized what happened there. And the next day, the plumber came and was charmed by my wine, and he spent the whole day here. And we just had this adventure, and I had to write it. I just had to connect the two events. about the way people connect through palette. Where I change it is that at the end I did end up giving the guy love advice, like I'm the last person in the world who could do that. But you know, I gave him a bottle of wine and told him exactly how to use this with women. Like, this is the one, you know, if she likes this, basically she's a keeper. If she likes this, like maybe she's good for one night, but I wouldn't go too seriously. And actually, I'd love to do a book based on that if I could.
That's a great idea. That's a great idea. We shouldn't be talking about it on the air because now someone else will do it. But no one would do it like you, so there's no worry there. So then in terms of essays, because you do, it sounds like you do quite a bit of essay writing. Do they typically come from a moment?
I think everything that I write always comes from a moment. I know people who write from character, and it's something that I never could do. Like when I used to write plays, I know people would write for a specific actress or actor. It's always from a moment, a color, or feeling, and that's it. And it goes from there. I'm very emotional. I take that moment and I fly with it. And I'm also always struck by the ironies of life, and so that always gets in there somehow.
Hmm. So then once you find that moment or find whatever is compelling you on to write, what does your process become like? I mean, do you, you know, quickly get a draft down and you know, then spend time working the draft, or do you labor over the draft and wait until, you know, write one paragraph after the previous paragraph is perfect? How does that go?
It seems that I have the process, the same process, whether I'm painting or making music or writing. I basically throw things immediately down and then I reshape them. And it's not the most efficient way of writing. I try not to censor myself in any way. I just write through to the end, or at least to a stopping point, at least as far as I can, to where I know I've got the kernel. I do not obsess about that first line. I obsess about that first line during the second draft. And, I'm a constant rewriter. I'm never finished rewriting, and sometimes I just have to pack it in. It's good enough, throw it out. The plumber piece was interesting because I actually put it up as a blog post first, and then because it's dangerous having a blog. I have an immediate audience. And then I went up about 4 hours later, I said, oh, my God, this is totally a modern love piece. I took it down as soon as possible. I tried to expunge. Actually, in those days, you could actually get Google to erase things. So I called Google, erase any cache you have of this. And I started writing it and deepening it. But it's really kind of this blob that's thrown on the page. And one of the things that I've been doing this, for a really long time, and one of the things that I sometimes mourn is the years, seems like there was a full decade where I was totally consumed by writing, and it was like falling in love every time I went into the page. And now it's more like work, but every once in a while, and thank goodness the moments still happen, like where I'm overcome. And The Plumber was one, the one I'm working on right now is another.
Hmm. Yeah. I wonder if part of that is the fact that there's so much other writing we do now. I mean, with blogging, if you have a blog and your blog is quite dense with material, I mean, it seems like you spend a lot of time on it.
I do. Too much. Like, oh my God, but you know, they're out there. They want me to write, and it's like perform. And it's you know, and sometimes I just don't have anything brilliant to say, so.
Let's give the blog address so people can find it.
Okay, it is actually my name, alicefering.com.
Great, yeah, there's so much information there. I mean, you know, I know when I saw your essay, I found your blog, and I just spent time. It's like, she has to have a book. There's all this blog. How do you ration the writing? I mean, because this is one of the things that writers seem to be afraid of in terms of starting to blog is that, what if I just do that and end up not doing other writing? How do I control it? Do I have to blog every day? Do I have to, you know, make sure it stays current? What do I do? I mean, how do you do that? Because you're working on, you know, books, you're working on essays, you're working on blogs.
Well, there is, I feel like I have to blog 3 times a week in some way, whether it's just a few sentences or full-fledged, you know, piece. And that's because I have between 6 to 8,000 readers a day, and I feel like I have an obligation to them. But also, I have an obligation. It's a very fine line. I think I'm the only full-time freelancer in the wine area that actually does have a wine blog.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And so one thing, I don't want to scoop myself because I don't make any money off of my blog. It's just purely for me and my readers. So I can't scoop myself. It is a very fine line. But it's also a great, an actor needs an audience and a writer needs an audience, and I have it ready made audience right there. And it's being a freelancer and being all alone in my, you know, in my study, it's nice to remember there are people out there reading you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, you know, as well as being entertaining and wonderful to read, you have so much information, so much wine information, which we have a few minutes left, and I have to ask you about California wines, because I'm in California. So what went wrong with California wines, and is there any hope?
your last part of that sentence got lost.
I said, is there any hope for California wines?
You're voting for them? Is that...
No, is there any hope?
Oh, any hope. Okay, hope. Is there any hope? Yes, there is hope for California wines. No, it's funny, I was asked to do that op-ed piece. I didn't actually go out. I did this op-ed piece about why I can't drink California wines for LA Times. And there is hope. I was just talking to somebody about this morning. I think right now the tide is turning. I meet so many people who say, you know, I want to like them and I can't. And even a lot of winemakers I know in California tell me that they make wines that they never drink. And I think at this point there's enough confidence that people have out there. They are starting to experiment with a kinder, gentler way of making wine. I know of a handful, and I know more are very curious. California can make great wine. I actually do believe that. They have made it before. Some people still make it. So yes, I'm not totally dismissive. I think in part I wrote that piece to promote the dialogue, to get a little bit, you know, to get it riled up and to get people thinking about it a little bit more.
Where is a country? What country is happening? Where are good wines coming from right now?
I hate to be boring about it, but France, and more France. And it's funny because all the news is about how, you know, France is making terrible wine and they're having to throw out their wine, and yes, there are oceans of wine lake. It's true, but some of the most rebellious winemakers, and by rebellious I mean really just making wine that the land wants to produce also with great skill, is happening in France at prices that even with the exchange rate, can't be beat.
Mm.
And that is beginning to filter down into Italy, Spain, Germany, Austria, and it's just now hitting the American shores.
Mm. Good news. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I wonder if you have any last words for the writers who are listening, who may be working on essays or working on a book of narrative nonfiction and just trying to figure it all out. Any advice?
Well, actually, I didn't know you were going to ask this question, but how can I pass it down? You know, and it's something I think that people say over and over, and especially now after the book and seeing what has happened to me in my career. I have always had a very, very specific voice, and I've always been asked, especially in some editorial writing, to tone it down. It's something that I never could do, and it's something that I didn't want to do. I'm really glad that I didn't. It's you get the point of view and run with it. And I just, you know, there's so many anonymous voices in the world that finding your own particular one is, you really have to be true to yourself.
Mm. Excellent advice. Yes. And thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Thank you, Barbara, for asking me and for finding me.
You're welcome. We'll talk again soon.
Yes, we will.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Alice Firing. She is author of The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization, published by Harcourt. It's a lovely book, a wonderful size, and distinct voice. It's good stuff. And do check out her website, too, which is wonderful. And now we're at the end of our time together. If you want to know more about the show, please go to my website, which is penonfire.com, named after my book, Pen on Fire. You can email me from the site if you want to be on my weekly email list. And I'm going to leave you with a quote by Anton Chekhov, who said, "Don't tell me the moon is shining. Show me the glint of light on broken glass." Thanks so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll see you next time.